the city, the quarry of people in search of something better. Now, the forces that are drawing people to the cities vary. Their hunger and floods, overpopulation, oppression, the higher aspirations, or the magnetism of urban life. Now, the city is the century's frontier. Although it's a second-hand frontier, in a way, it's the last surviving outpost of the deprived. The people whom I've seen heading urbanward are mostly different from the established city dwellers. Here in the United States, they're Negroes, Puerto Ricans, and Mexicans. In England, they're Jamaicans. They're tribesmen in Africa going into the cities. Oppressed Muslims in India, forced into Pakistan, or Hindus forced into India. There, some million lives were lost. There are Chinese refugees who are fleeing into Hong Kong, and people with rural folkways that are heading for the cities almost everywhere. One sees in cities of the world new varieties of people whose habits, languages, religions, races, or colors contrast sharply with those of the established urban groups. Despite the vast implications for the society in which we live, the two problems about which the world seems to know least are urbanization and social conflict. These two issues are the vortices around which social stabilization and probably even peace will revolve. In the cities, people are competing for jobs, for homes, and for survival. Millions of people are seeking shelter and seizing land in the effort to get roofs over their heads. In cities like Ankara, Turkey, the squatter population is almost 50%. Because there is no land or housing available for the people, they simply seize land and put their own little shacks up wherever they can. In Manila, the squatter population is about 25%. In Latin American cities, I've seen the squatter population range anywhere from 10 to 30%. In contrast to the sequential revolutions which have occurred in Europe and America over a space of time and with the opportunity for absorption, these newly industrializing countries are experiencing a whole series of revolutions at once. The Industrial Revolution, the Political Revolution, the Social Revolution is confronting them simultaneously. And if these countries can survive the impacts of change until they can firm the tenuous fabrics of their new urban societies, I think it would be a boon. And if, in addition, some of them can acquire or salvage some of the democratic norms that were developed in Europe and the United States, I think it would be an unanticipated blessing for the world. But the prospects are not too promising. Similarly sensitive and crucial, I believe, is the problem of social conflict in the world. And from the Hitler exterminations of minority people to the situation at this moment in Cyprus, the world has been experiencing crisis after crisis brought about by national, ethnic, religious, or social differences. And unless we can come up with some answers in this country or in Europe, these crises will continue erupting as urbanization continues and as minority conflicts assert themselves. You have more sensitive situations in the cities than you have in the old agricultural society, where there was spatial separation between groups. In the cities, they're being brought head-on and face-to-face with each other, with their variations in background and in mores. Well, the United States is probably the world's great laboratory in which some of these issues are being tested and in which the techniques for resolving them are being weighed. The racial conflicts that are now appearing in our northern cities are only the most recent manifestations of both the world problem and the problem in America. From the alien and sedition laws in the United States in about 1830 to know-nothingism, this nation has experienced these conflicts and survived them. Despite the critical eruptions of the last two decades, the democratic system in the United States seems to have demonstrated its greater capacity to endure the fatigue that democracy exacts and to ignore the progress that minorities have made, and to see only the frictions is seeing only the darker side of the picture. Anti-Catholic sentiment has subsided. Despite the influx of minorities from Europe, their assimilation has or is being achieved. Despite the stubbornness of the Negro problem, gains are being made in employment, in civil rights, in education, and in housing. A little more than a decade ago, it was impossible in the North for a Negro to register at a hotel here even in New York or venture into a restaurant without embarrassment, without a waiter saying that the table is reserved. It was impossible for a Negro girl to get a job as a stenographer or work in a department store or a bank. And today, while many of these stubborn barriers still persist, the initial breakthroughs, I think, have been made. The unresolved aspect of our Negro problem today is whether the gains can be broadened and whether they can be secured. And one of the most serious obstacles is the housing problem and the racial frictions that the housing problem generates. The city is serving its traditional role ever since God ordered Cain to repair to a city. It's serving its traditional role as the haven of the disprivileged in America, of those escaping oppression or fear. But in the United States, the peculiar jurisdictional entities in the American body politic, which were seated in the traditions of home rule and local autonomy, which held high place in the United States, have contributed to the concentration of Negroes in cities and their exclusion from these suburban belts. Within the cities, you're seeing very significant changes. Washington, D.C. today is about 55% Negro inhabited. Detroit is about 30%. Newark, 37%. Philadelphia, 25%. Cleveland, 25%. And the trend may be only in its beginnings. These concentrations have complicated the nation's public school system, which has always been the pivot around which neighborhood and social stability revolved. White parents, seeing classrooms fill up with Negro children, scurry about from their neighborhoods, and they send their children to white private schools, or they head for the suburbs. This has happened in Washington and in other cities. The Negro's presence in the North, of course, is not a new phenomenon. Greenwich Village, for instance, in which I'm now delivering this talk, in about 1850, was about 25% Negro. Nor has the Negro always been held in low esteem as a neighbor. Before he moved in great numbers, he held down respectable jobs and was more highly regarded as a slum dweller than even his European neighbors. And Jacob Riis wrote in 1902, "Where the Negro pitches his tent, he pays more rent than his white neighbor next door and is a better tenant." Well, the Negro is not so dominant a percentage of total population as to threaten the overshadowing of the white man. Negroes formed 20% of the total population at the time of the American Revolution. Today, they're only 11.6%. And since more than half of the Negroes are still in the South, or about half, their presence, considering the fact that they're about 11% of the population, would hardly be noticeable in the North and West if they were more widely distributed. As for the South, three states had a Negro majority or near majority at the time of the Confederacy, and there are no such states today. In short, a redistribution of population has occurred. The Negro is more heavily represented in industrial cities, but he's a small minority in the new, growing metropolitan areas, because he's not represented in the suburbs. But his substantial presence within the cities and his virtual absence from suburbia sparks fears in the whole metropolitan area that he'll move rapidly into the suburbs, change its school composition, affect the suburban social status, and challenge its white formations. Now, in touching off movements of the better taxpayers to suburbia, the Negro is therefore a factor in all urban economies in the United States, and we are becoming a nation that is going to be almost totally urban. We're about 70% urban. That includes suburban, which is also urban. And between now and the year 2000, which is not so far off, another 150 million people will be added to the population in cities. In widening the urban slum formations, the Negro is a factor in the urban social structure. The pattern of his settlement in cities and his numbers, coupled with his strategic political significance as a voting majority, also makes him a factor in elections. And finally, the Negro problem is one of the great unsolved problems of American democracy, one of the most glaring exceptions to our claim of equality, and probably the most publicized American social contradiction in the world contest of ideologies. Our Negro income has increased sharply in recent years. Median Negro income, nevertheless, despite the sharp increase, is still only about $3,191, that's 1961, as against $5,981 for white families, about two-thirds in the northeastern states. Two-thirds of the white income. The Negro is still the last to be hired and the first to be fired. His unemployment rate is about twice that of the white worker. He continues to hold the menial jobs which give him menial status in the social structure. His housing problem has often caused neighborhood ferment, stirring the hostility of whites. Now, the Negro's housing problem is part of a vicious circle. I noticed this when I was chairman of the State Commission. Lack of training and equipment, combined with prejudice, are partly responsible for his continuing low income. Low income is responsible for slum life. Slum life, low income, and a lower level of training and education contribute to the stereotype and generate and regenerate the bias among whites. Whenever the Negro improves his earnings and competes for a better house, he challenges the social status of neighborhoods, and he sparks fears and resentments of his white neighbors. Then, as more industries head out for the suburbs, and they are doing it to get the one-story factories, pay the cheaper rents, and be in better surroundings, as they head for these outlying areas, either the industry is reluctant to hire the Negro, because the industrial or the personnel manager doesn't want to offend the local banks and the local people and the politicians. And so the hiring is pretty tough in suburbia. Or if he is hired, His journey to work becomes too oppressive because he has to live in the city. A study I made for the state of California within the last year indicated that people are living more and more, about two-thirds of the people in California living in the same county in which their work is located, with the exception of the Negro, who has to cross the city or the county line to get to his work. But generally, about two-thirds of the people who work in a county or a city live in a city. Restriction of residence thus means restriction of opportunity. Improvement of education, training, income, and housing are all interrelated. Better housing in both city and suburb at reasonable cost would drive a wedge into this impenetrable circle. Now, thanks to the white exodus from cities and the Negroes' improved income, some better housing has become available in the city. It's come hard in some cases against racial covenants, against zoning practices, and even against rioting. But the Negro has made only insignificant headway in the outer fringes. In the contest for space, the Negro has seen official power being used to keep him in his place or to evict him. This abuse of public power has increased as his challenge to white communities has become sharper. There's no shortage of land in the United States. All of the urban land in the United States occupies only 1% of the land area. There is a competition for this little 1% all over the country, a competition for homes, a competition for factories, a competition for cemeteries and for golf courses. And as far as the residences are concerned, the competition insists that it be all white. Now, this is not altogether the white man's fault. I blame government for this to a great extent. For 15 years, from about 1935 to about 1950, government housing programs and Negro exclusion proceeded apace. You know, the government went into housing around 1934 as an emergency measure to restore, to buoy up economic conditions. And for the first time became an active participant in housing enterprise. And before that, the relationship between government and private enterprise was one where the government had the higher ethic, the ethic of the policeman, of the monitor, the ethic of the person of the political power that regulated the selfish power of the private entrepreneur, regulated him through housing laws, through health laws, through zoning ordinances, and so forth. And the private entrepreneur operated on an entirely different ethic. It was the ethic of laissez-faire, I am not my brother's keeper, and let the devil take the hindmost. Now, this wasn't a bad system because the higher ethic of government would gradually raise up the level of the lower ethic of private enterprise in the competitive system so that ultimately some balance of morality would prevail in this interplay between the governmental and the private process. But then something suddenly happened when the government stepped into the mortgage insurance business and became part of the whole pattern of enterprise. And these The government, particularly the FHA and the home loan bank system, began to advocate devices for excluding Negroes and Jews and other minorities in manuals, the pages of which on these sections could have been culled out of the Nuremberg laws. It's incredible. The federal government, first of all, insisted upon discriminatory practices as a condition for government aid in housing. FHA's official manuals cautioned against, and here I quote, infiltration of inharmonious racial and national groups, or a lower class of inhabitants, or the presence of incompatible racial elements in the new neighborhoods. Here's another quote. The social class of the parents of children at the schools was declared to have a vital bearing on whether a neighborhood was stable. A neighborhood was to be considered less desirable if inhabited by a lower level of society. Here, FHA added a little postscript to the effect that this could be remedied by having the children attend another school with pupils of the same social class. Stables and pig pens were put by FHA in the same category as a section occupied by the wrong race. Wrong, in quotes. Zoning was advocated as a device for exclusion, and the use was urged of a restrictive covenant prepared by FHA itself, this government agency, with a space for the prohibited races, Jews, Negroes, Syrians, and so forth, left blank to be filled in by the builder as occasion required, and you couldn't get an FHA loan unless there was a restrictive covenant. And so for 15 years, a period in which about more than 15 million homes were built, federal housing agencies pursued a concerted, relentless, and officially sanctioned drive to keep people living only with their own kind and get them to impose intrusions by anybody else who is different. Federally approved racial covenants covered the greater part of suburbia. Neighborhoods were divided into those of the elite and the unwanted, the desirables and the undesirables, and intolerance gained such rapid headway that men in high national office now saw nothing wrong in signing restrictive covenants, one of the most popular of which barred not only Negroes, but Jews, Armenians, Persians, and Syrians. One of the candidates for the vice presidency of the United States signed a covenant against Jews and Negroes, but it couldn't be brought up in the election because his opponent also signed one. But this was taken for granted. I remember representing a very famous man who happened to be a Jew, who was in government employ, and who now holds very high office. And I came across, when he wanted to buy the house, I found that there was a restrictive covenant barring him. And I came to the conclusion that no Jew could ever live in the White House, live anywhere but the White House. That was the only, virtually the only place that wasn't covered by a restrictive covenant. And these covenants were going around wildly in the area outside of central Washington, in the residential areas. Practically every section had one. Well, after 1946, following the Hitler outrages, a moral renaissance manifested itself in the United States. The restrictive covenants were held unenforceable, and the federal government slowly but steadily moved from a policy of direct racial discrimination in publicly aided undertakings to an affirmative policy of non-discrimination. I was discussing last night just how this came about. One of the factors was that Mrs. Roosevelt niggled Mr. Roosevelt. Not about this, but about desegregating the army while we were fighting the cause of democracy and so forth. That when Harry Truman got in, he just ordered FHA to knock out these restrictive covenants after the Supreme Court decision simply because it made common sense to do so, since the Supreme Court had held it unenforceable. But a renaissance took place. It was probably in the aftermath of the war and spiritual uplift it gave and the focus on the racial question. Anyway, after the restrictive covenant came the decision of the Supreme Court outlawing segregation and discrimination in public transportation, and thereafter in schools. Laws were simultaneously enacted in numerous states outlawing discrimination in employment, while by November 1, 1962, we had 17 states, the Virgin Islands, and 56 cities, which had already passed anti-discrimination laws, going completely the opposite direction. They were all enforcing zoning ordinances. Now we had this tendency to outlaw discrimination in housing, with the Negro question being the main question, the main focus in the United States. 12 states went even further by outlawing bias in private housing not receiving government aid. These laws affect more than 65 million people, and more recently, the federal executive order prohibited discrimination in federally assisted housing. Completely reversed now. While anti-bias laws such as these have helped break down some segregated patterns, the development of the essential techniques for effecting greater progress seems to have lagged. The housing program has too often become involved with symbols, semantic perversions, shibboleths, distorted slogans. A reformer who dares to venture a constructive suggestion may be shunned for uttering a word alien to the accepted vernacular. One who opposes wholesale eviction of Negroes from slums may be accused of opposing slum clearance and even public housing. An advocate of a functioning integrated pattern in a community where the housing authority temporarily shelves Negro applications for housing or schools that threaten to alter the pattern, make it all Negro, will be accused of advocating a quota system. If one favors higher income limits for public housing so as to encourage white as well as Negro occupancy, it's equivalent to opposing tenant selection on the basis of need. And it's apparent that a re-examination of all of these existing shibboleths is long overdue, and that what we need really is some technical knowledge of this vastly unexplored problem. We're in the period of emotional stress, emotional expression of our desires, of the ethics of the situation, but we're far from evolving the essential techniques here or in any part of the world. Segregation, which is a much abused term in the dictionary of social reform, is not always as bad as it sounds. Of course, all of these things are made much much worse than they actually are. Every ethnic or national group lives with its own people where it feels it can build a greater sense of security, create its own institutions, and raise its members with greater dignity. Harlem is a ghetto, but it's an exaggeration to assert that it's an enforced ghetto for all Negroes, or that if it were completely, or that it lacks a culture, or that if it were torn down and its Negro population were allowed to live wherever it chose, that the same voluntary racial formations would not form in other sections. The test, I think, is not whether a grouping is segregated, but whether there are elements of compulsion which keep its members in place when they are ready, willing, and able to live elsewhere. In the case of the Negro, I think that today, with the suburban situation and the exclusionary devices, all of the compulsive elements, social, political, and economic, are present in most metropolitan areas of the nation, and particularly in the outskirts of the central cities, where 80% of the new housing is being built. The central cities are performing their historic role of the refuge, but there's no denying that the new smaller suburbs and the smaller cities forming around the primate cities are compulsively keeping the Negro out when he's ready to move. Even in many of the older and larger cities, there are still forces at work to keep him in his place or oust him from the central sections. In Washington, D.C., urban renewal is becoming a device to throw out Negroes out, and I've seen this in California and other places, where there's an old Negro pocket, perhaps a rural pocket. You use urban renewal to throw him into the city. And this is one of the dangers of the expansion of political power, that is, the perversion of public power, which, after all, public power is the expression of the will of the majority. Always, as power expands, the threat that the power will be perverted, and that even social reforms, dignified social reforms, will be perverted into instruments of oppression. particularly in housing. Zoning became racial zoning. The restrictive covenant, which was a covenant to maintain proper uses in neighborhoods, became the racial restrictive covenant. And urban renewal in many of our cities is a form of displacing unwanted Negroes. We're now at the point where the progress made is being threatened. And it's being threatened by the continued immunity of the savings and loan associations, which receive immunity under the president's executive order. And these associations, I think, are the largest lenders on homes, and though federally aided by credits and deposit insurance, they're free to discriminate and create all-wide enclaves. Builders, within the last year, since the president's order, have begun to prefer savings and loan financing, despite the higher costs of such financing. And it's becoming manifest that the executive order has got to be broadened if the minority's housing problem is to be eased. I think that these orders of this sort and legislation to outlaw discrimination is important. I think that progress is being threatened also by mass urban renewal displacements, in which these local governments faced with Negro pockets are employing the program as a means of dislodging them, and about 65% of the persons who are displaced in urban renewal are Negroes. I think that progress is being threatened by the lack of technical knowledge on how to deal with the problem, which I referred to before. The official agencies at the state and local levels have still not developed the techniques for breaking down segregation. And while literature has developed on the moral issues of segregation and discrimination, little has been written and little is known about the devices for stabilizing neighborhoods, overcoming segregation, and eliminating fears of loss of social status and of real estate values. I think that the progress that's been made in the last 15 years is being threatened by suburban exclusion practiced in the name of local autonomy. We're developing in this country thousands of Mason-Dixon lines in the north in which local public power is being used to enforce exclusion. I think progress is also being threatened by the Negro himself. Not by all Negroes, but by some Negro groups. The contest for leadership has threatened to divide the moral forces that have stood together for a long time and that have been responsible for much of the progress that's been made. If that progress is to continue, it's imperative that the Negro leadership and the church leadership and the civic leadership remain concerted in their efforts and in their programs. This is a moral issue. If you depend on it solely as a political issue, I think there's an offset. There are enough votes to be gained against the Negro if you pitch it solely on the basis of the political strength of the Negro. I think that if real progress is to be made and if the progress already achieved is to be maintained, that it must remain a moral issue, and the moral forces, particularly the church, must hold the line, the moral line, with the Negro leadership, with the responsible Negro leadership. I think progress is being threatened also by the failure to proffer the right kind of aid and legislation in this fight. While the two issues which have gained national attention are discrimination and poverty, and when I was chairman of the State Commission Against Discrimination, we wrote a report called, a very big report, called Discrimination and Poverty. Unfortunately, it was issued just before Mr. Rockefeller defeated Mr. Harriman, and no, very few people except the writers ever have got access to it. But it says many of the things which are being talked about now. But while these two issues of discrimination and poverty are in the forefront at the present time, both of them are involved with the condition of the city and with the housing problem. The city is where poverty is. And while you may help the individual to raise himself up You also have a simultaneous responsibility, if you want to meet the problem of poverty, of regenerating the climate and the opportunities in which the poor person lives. Now, I think anti-discrimination laws can be helpful, but not alone. For example, I think we must pass on to a new phase, a phase that recognizes that discrimination can't be solved by anti-discrimination laws alone, that you need another type of legislation. You need constructive legislation in housing, for example, which can enable the majority of poorer people to rent housing within their means or to buy housing within their means. This doesn't mean only public housing. A person is entitled to buy a home, and with the same subsidy that is provided for public housing, a poor family can buy a home. That is, the subsidy amounts to about the interest on the mortgage, and if you eliminated the interest on the mortgage, or if in other cases you gave it at 1% or 2%, a poor person could own a home, and poor people do own homes. I remember when I was first counsel to the Housing Authority, I was shocked when I found that when we leveled some of the slums in this city, that 25% of the people we put out were homeowners. And all we could offer them, this was in Brooklyn particularly, and all we could offer them was tenancy in a public housing project. Well, I think that if you're going to establish a climate in which there is freedom of choice, and that means not only public housing, then you have to have rent subsidies. And you have to have home ownership at subsidized interest rates. And only when you give people a choice, and a choice that they can exercise because you've made it possible for them to exercise it, will blast the poverty problem and the housing problem and some of the other problems and the school segregation problems that are part of it. Now, this is realistic thinking. If you begin to think solely of shibboleths like discrimination and housing and you've got to solve the housing problem without saying how, without specifying the particular program. If you talk about the quota system, give an ugly word to a good intention of a public agency, you'll never get anywhere with this problem. But if you aim at the right legislation, if you broaden the public housing program, for instance, to expand it into a home ownership program, and you give rent subsidies so that people can live wherever they choose, provided it's in a decent home, then you begin to solve the problem, the housing problem and all of the other by-problems that come out of it. In sum, I think we're at the crossroads, and an issue which has confronted the nation since its origins may be resolved in our time, or it may continue frustrating our democratic objectives. The hazard, I think, is always at the point where the breakthrough comes into view. When an issue challenges the interests and the prerogatives of a nation's majority, there's always the likelihood that this majority will look for rationalizations of conscience to conform with its immediate interest. It's at this point that misestimation of strategy by the minority becomes dangerous, and that the ethical leadership of the church and the liberal and the civic forces must join with the responsible Negro leadership in holding this moral line. And the moral line, in turn, must be reinforced by the proper and the constructive legislation and the devices. Now, if we're at the point of crisis, we're also at the turning point of opportunity. An opportunity, I think, which, if won, can reaffirm for the nation the moral leadership which it has held since it first asserted the proposition that men were equal.